If I speak, I am condemned. If I stay silent, I am damned. Who am I? Who am I allowed to be?
Welcome to Connected Communication, a podcast exploring the intriguing interplay between language, culture, and the brain through the lens of self-awareness. I'm your host, Christine.
I put on the soundtrack to Les Misérables at the weekend. It's one of my favourite musicals. My sister took me to see it in London for my 30th birthday, and I was blown away by the vocal performances. The opening line of the podcast is from one of the songs. Jean Valjean is questioning his identity as another man is being mistaken for him. As I was half listening, half hearing. What do you mean by half listening, half hearing, Christine? I hear you ask. It's a good question. What indeed does it mean to listen? And what does it mean to hear? Is the meaning the same in different languages? What of the mannerisms? It's International Women's Day this week. Last week I talked about listening triggers across sexes, the impact of emotional repression when speaking, and how women have traditionally had to change how they speak in order to be heard, particularly by the opposite sex, sometimes by other women too. Men's voices are subject to judgment as well, I know, but they don't tend to have to make as many intentional adaptations to be heard and listened to. I actually saw it evidenced last week. I put out my post about the episode, quite raw, quite honest, about the truth of the fact that women have to adapt. And at the same time last week, I saw two posts, both by men, about listening and one about how women are treated. Both of them got about 10 times the interaction mine did. It felt like LinkedIn was showing the men's posts more than mine. Now, that could just be my frustrated woman coming out in me. Mine was probably a bit too raw for people to accept it and take it. But that's exactly the point. Women can't communicate in the way they want to, in the way they want to share messages. We have to adapt. The truth is, people don't want to hear the truth. Men don't have to make as many intentional adaptations to be heard and listened to. Christine, why do you keep separating listening and hearing? I hear you ask. Because they're not the same thing. When you learn a language, you learn passive and active skills. The active skills are considered to be speaking and writing. You have to actively engage to produce language. Traditionally, listening and reading have been considered passive. In actual fact, they're not. Not if you want to comprehend or remember anything anyway. A comment from one of my live viewers on this topic in 2022 summed up this misunderstanding perfectly. He spoke about taking English exams, saying that he didn't need to listen for mood or emotion to be able to answer the questions in an exam. He just needed to pick out the contextual words and match them to the right question. How incredibly wrong he was. I was an IELTS teacher for a number of years, and a speaking examiner for a while, official and unofficial, as can happen when you work globally. One of the key requirements of the listening test, which applies to life listening also, is the ability to demonstrate an understanding of the inferred emotion of the speaker. You get this by listening actively to not only their words, but their tone of voice, pitch, pace, power, and pause. The modulation facets of English. The music of the language, which helps you identify the tune being played and fully understand the meaning behind it. To hear it, we must actively listen. That means intentionally paying attention to what the speaker says and how they say it, sometimes reading between the lines for the truth. A perfect example of this is the question, what does it mean when a British person says, I'm sure it's my fault? The world incorrectly perceives English to be a non-tonal language, and English speakers to be low-context, direct communicators, compared, for example, to high-context, indirect Chinese communicators. Now, I'm fully aware that there are no tones in English, compared to the 4 tones of Mandarin and, I think, 9 in Cantonese. However, there are multiple emotional tones and multiple inflections. Single, double, triple, ooh, for example. I teach all of these in the resources if you choose to sign up to support the podcast. Or actually, maybe wait. In a couple of weeks, it's the podcast's anniversary, 1 year podcasting. I'm going to announce how you can impact another person's life by signing up to the resources. So hold off for a bit if you were thinking of doing it. Whose fault is implicated when a British person says, "I'm sure it's my fault"? Yours. And you need to be able to understand the words and the tone of voice to catch that. This is why there's so much breakdown in international communication. People are not traditionally trained to listen. They only learn to hear. And what is hearing? Hearing happens, whether you want it to or not, as long as you have the physical faculties to do so. Has anyone ever said to you, "Oh, sorry, I didn't hear you," while checking their phone as you spoke, prompting you to want to reply, no, you weren't listening"? Listening is a conscious action. Hearing happens. El significado es lo mismo en español. The meaning is the same in Spanish. As I said, in a couple of weeks, actually on March 19th, spring equinox, the podcast turns 1 year podcasting. I'm very proud of that. But I can also see how far I have to go. Poco a poco, little by little. And I will be doing a few giveaways again, like I said, so make sure you stay tuned. In year 2, I'm thinking of niching part of the podcast, focusing on Hiberno English, Irish and Spanish, how our languages, pronunciations and cultures connect, and how those connections influence our identity and our perceptions. I'll bring in guests from other languages to explore and compare theirs too. Let's see to what degree language shapes identity. Shall we? En un página web, on a website, I found a lovely description of the difference between listen and hear in español. Escuchar y oír. Escuchar is listen, oír is hear. When translated on Google, I did it to make sure I fully understood it. We see how far technology still needs to go in understanding the true meaning of words. In Spanish it reads, "La acción de oír es involuntaria. Es decir, no estamos esperando o atentos a la llegada de un sonido. Sin embargo, al producirse ese sonido, lo percibimos y sabemos procesarlo. Vaya, que queramos o no, lo oiremos, pues el oído está activo y cumple con su función. Dicho de otra manera, un ruido por sorpresa, gritos, una detonación o un portazo, no se escucha, sino que se oye." In English, translated on Google, this is, "The action of hearing is involuntary. That said, we're not waiting or paying attention to a sound or to the arrival of a sound. However, when a sound is produced, we perceive it and we know how to process it. Whether we want to or not, we hear it because the ear is active and completing its function." But said in another way, a surprise sound, and this is the part where it gets interesting with the Google translation, a surprise sound, a scream, an explosion, or a door slamming, no se escucha, sino que se oye. In correct translation, that would be, is not listened to, but heard. But when we translate that on Google, Google says, is not heard, but heard. Somewhat concerning, eh? If Google doesn't understand the meaning between listen and hear, what on earth does AI not know? How about in Irish? Well, my Spanish is actually better than my Irish at the minute, but my memory draws forward a teacher's voice. An bhfuil tú a géisteacht. Are you listening? Tá mé géisteacht. I am listening, I'd say. Cad a thuaile tú? What did you hear? I remember my sister telling me once she'd heard my grandparents getting amorous. My response? Ah, Lydia, I can't unhear that. I can't unsee it either. Even though I didn't see it, what was happening in my brain there? No two brains are the same, just like no two languages or cultures are. The more the world is learning about the brain, the more people are being taught what neuroscientists are discovering about the brain that mystics, shamans, and healers have known for years, the easier it is becoming for people to acknowledge and accept neurodivergence. Neurodivergence isn't a new thing. We just didn't have the technology to prove that people's brains work differently. We allowed square pegs to be jammed into round holes and damaged a lot of perfectly operational equipment in the process. Teachers and parents used to say things like, "Sit down and do what you're told." "Because I said so, that's why." Or, "You're just a teenager. Your interpretation of Sylvia Plath's poetry isn't correct. Learn what you've been instructed." Must I lie? Must I conform to fit into your society? Yes, that last example is etched into my memory. I won't pretend to be an expert in the area of neurodivergence. I have a sneaking suspicion, based on what I know about ADHD, that my brain is wired that way. I have yet to investigate it, though I'm not entirely sure I want to open that Pandora's box of anxiety. I've done just fine up to now. What I do know is that I operate much more efficiently when I play certain types of music in the background as I work. That having something under my feet to move while I'm typing helps me stay focused. And that once I get into something, I hyperfocus, sometimes not surfacing for hours for a break. That doesn't sound like the deficit disorder I've heard about. I thought it meant you couldn't pay attention, you're disorganized and you're impulsive. Ah, what has your brain been primed to understand when you hear the letters ADHD? What did your mind's eye show you when I said I couldn't unsee the story about my grandparents? Your brain is primed to hear. And, unless you're one of the 3.9% of people with aphantasia, to see things in a particular way. What do you mean by primed? We have a saying in English, primed and ready. It indicates when something or someone is prepared for immediate use. I shouldn't say someone is prepared for immediate use. Not that you're not using a person. Yeah, although the truth is that actually people are used in certain ways. So that line probably does have some sort of truth to it. But anyway, in my late teens, I went out with a panel beater. Panel beaters fix crash cars. I'd never heard of half the words he used for the work he did. Primer was one of them. Before a car is painted, it's given a coat of primer. If you get your nails done, they may be coated with primer before the polish is put on, to prepare them for the polish. Anything that's primed is prepared for what's to come. Primed and ready. The brain is no different. When we learn a language, our brain is primed to hear that language in a particular way. When we learn the customs and traditions of a particular culture, our brain is primed to perceive the world in a particular way. When we don't learn that other languages and cultures perceive the world in different ways, our brains are primed to... How did you finish my sentence? That answer will depend on how your brain is primed. Let's do an example. When I hold up my index finger, the first finger of my hand beside my thumb, and I curl it in slightly. What does that mean? To an English speaker, it may represent a hook. when I lived in China. Not understanding that finger movement led to a server in a restaurant thinking I wasn't going to pay for my meal. To a Mandarin speaker, it's the number 9. He was showing me 9 kuai and 9 renminbi. Despite all the research I'd done, I had missed out on the fact that in China, they count to 10 on one hand. My brain got primed differently that day. As I mentioned a wee while ago, last week when I posted the episode on listening and listening across sexes, I saw a great post on LinkedIn about the difference between listening and hearing. It had some excellent tips on how to become a more active listener, particularly as leaders. I agreed with much of it. But there were aspects I'd have opened a discussion on had I been in the room with the creator. Given the nature of the post, I didn't express my full true feelings on it. Why? It would have made it look like I wasn't actively listening, like I was ignoring the message in the post. Must I lie? Must I conform to fit into your society? There's a great danger in social media posting and commenting. Tone is lost. Attitude is easily misconstrued. Commentators are easily misunderstood. Women are often seen as difficult if they don't agree with what's been written. We must conform to some degree to be accepted in society. But to what degree? To what extent ought we to have to conform? Let's take one of Ireland's most powerful representations of women as an example. Grainne Whale, our pirate queen, or Grace O'Malley, as ye English speakers might know her. I got a bit excited when I was starting to explore our legendary lady of the seas. First, I looked at her name, thinking I might be able to find a link in my ancestry. I still haven't given up on that wee hope. My surname in Irish is Ní, to represent that I'm female, followed by Whaleoni. The first part, Whale, is exactly the same as Grainne's given surname, Whale. Now, there are two theories about the origins of my name. One is that it dates back to the 14 or 1500s in Connacht in the west of Ireland, where Grainne was born in 1530. Grainne was given the surname, or the nickname, Whale, as the story goes, because she was forced to conform to be accepted onto her father's ship. Having repeatedly been told that she couldn't board the ship because of her long locks of hair and that they'd get caught in the ropes, she, supposedly according to the legend, shaved them all off. Whale means bald in Irish. Bald Grainne. She was also bold. And it was her boldness that made her one of the most legendary and inspirational of the Irish women whose shoulders I'm blessed to be able to stand on. My grandmother is another one. I interviewed her last year for the podcast. I can't remember the episode number now. Or you go back, you'll see grandmother in the title. And I was chatting to her again last weekend, telling her about a TEDx talk I'm pitching to give. And she, not for the first time, told me the story about how she used to complain about the priests. "Mammy, they're just men. I don't know why you're getting out the good china for them. You could get it out for anybody." "Don't say things like that, Anna. You can't say things like that. Tell me you don't say things like that out in the street to people." "I would say it. Why wouldn't I say it?" So I was telling her about this TEDx talk that I'm pitching to give. It's related to language. I'll keep you posted now if I get accepted on it. And her memory's not the greatest these days, but she fires up when we speak. I think I have a way of getting her going. And she said on the phone the other day, "Christine, language is one of the most important things we have. When we lose our language, we retreat into ourselves. That's why I always used to go and sit with the elderly when I was in a cafe and saw them sitting alone. You might be the only person they communicate with that day. After a few minutes, when they realise you're really interested in listening to them, you watch how they light up." I know where I get a lot of my traits from when I hear Granny speak like this. The women in our lives teach us many things. One of the most important is how to listen so a person feels heard, and how to speak so others will listen. That's different across cultures and brains, as I mentioned earlier. Like Grainne, when she strategically answered the 18 questions posed to her, permitting her audience with Queen Elizabeth I, and the resulting return of her lands, we need to understand the political importance of adjusting how we speak so we can be heard, and how we listen to be able to hear. I'm still on the fence about how much we need to adjust. I'm getting a little bit to the end of my rope in terms of not being able to say things that I want to say because people will get too upset. I think we're getting a bit too sensitive, to be totally honest with you. And I definitely still see on social media where women have to soften how they say things so that they'll be heard better by a society which deems women not to have strong voices which openly object to things. We have to sugarcoat them. So as I say, I'm still a bit on the fence with how much we should have to adapt, but it is necessary to be mindful to the best degree possible without having to overly analyse it, to pay attention, to adjust how we speak so we can be heard, and how we listen to be able to hear. Hearing happens automatically. Our brains are primed. We're naturally biased towards that which we know. If I say black and, English speakers say white. If I say blanco y, Spanish speakers say negro. The binomial is flipped. The brain is not primed to hear language in the same order, depending on the language, even though the meaning is the same. And so we begin the practice of attunement. And this is why I say my jury's still out on how much we should have to adapt. Because we focus so much on speakers having to adapt, on the person who's producing the message, the active part of things. But we need to take the passive out of listening. The practice of attunement allows us to do that. It makes listening active. Caregivers attune to the needs of their patients. Lovers attune to the needs of their partners. Musicians in an orchestra attune to the movements of the conductor. The brain can also attune to the speaker. But we have to teach it to. How? By becoming familiar with what I call the spiral of awareness. The four aspects that make up what I am developing as the neurocultural communication model. Self-awareness. Understand how your ear is attuned. What kind of voices do you lean into? What kinds of voices make you back away and scrunch your face in distaste? Wait, Christine, you can't say things like that. Well, in fact, I can say whatever I like, particularly on a podcast. It's up to you how you choose to hear it. We're not designed to like everything equally. We're not primed to understand everything equally. Acknowledging and accepting that we are biased for and against certain things is the first step towards adjusting how we respond. Some people like pineapple on pizza. Does that make them bad people? It's not bad people that are the problem. It's dysfunctional systems. We can change systems, but it means rewiring. And that's where the next phase comes in. Brain awareness. My initial coach training and experience is in neuroscience. Recently, a leader of a large coaching organization said to me, "Nonsense," when I mentioned brain-based coaching. "Take our course," they said. "Nonsense is only nonsense until someone with a voice powerful enough on the world stage has made sense of it and told people to think it makes sense. It was once nonsense to think that there would be a personal computer in every household across the globe. Now, we're not there yet, but we're well on the way towards it." The coaching industry has been priming people's brains for years to think that a coach must have a credential to be worthy of employment. It's another way to limit individuals' access to certain industries and make them question themselves and amass a lot of money in the process. I know a lot of coaches who've got their accreditation certificates just because they feel they have to. They'll admit, though not publicly, that they don't coach in the way they've been credentialed to, because they know that people are individuals. I'm not knocking the competencies and intentions behind certificates and accreditations. I'm certifying all the time. I'll continue doing my certifications and training. But I'm not going to get accredited just because I need to tick a box for other people to see me as something that a standard has been created by. Yeah, I know. That's the groan you wail inside me, setting my own standards. Don't let me be misunderstood. I stand by the ICF competencies. They're the standards by which I hold myself to when I coach. But I'm not going to pretend I don't adapt to my clients' needs just to get a badge. I'm aware of how my brain works. Pretending goes against its grain. Why must I lie? The Neuro Leadership Institute, which is ICF accredited, teaches us about the SCARF, human drivers of behaviour, and the SEEDS model of bias, amongst many other fantastic and immediately applicable models. More than any other models I've tried, they have had the most instantaneous impact on my clients' awareness and actions. Insights work. Results-focused, brain-based coaching models that are simplified and applied realistically to people's lives make sense. Next week you'll hear me talk to Rachel Paling, my first coach, and the woman who introduced me to neuro-language coaching. Hers is the same. Simplified models that make neuroscience acceptable. On my fridge I have a quote. When you see through yourself, you'll see through anybody. Tony DeMello. My dad used to quote him to me all the time when I was younger, to the point where I didn't know Tony DeMello, but I didn't like him. That changed as I became an adult. The more you understand about your brain, about yourself, the better you are able to reshape how it thinks. And one way to do that is through language awareness. Our brains are primed, as I mentioned before. The fourth part of the model is language awareness. We're primed to hear things before they're said. We are, as David Rock puts it, prediction machines. Language awareness, not necessarily knowing lots of other languages, but just an awareness that languages are different, significantly reduces incidences of communication breakdown. In Irish, we say, have you got Irish? So have you any Irish? Instead of, do you speak it? So I think we'd say, Kivéd Changa Tautu, how many languages do you have? As opposed to, how many languages do you speak a Laureen to? In English, like you said, that might become, have you any English? And in Spanish, hablar is used. ¿Cuántos idiomas hablas? How many languages do you speak? There are different types of language, not just languages of different countries. I've been a teacher since I was 16. My mum was my speech and drama teacher. Granny taught literacy at the time to disadvantaged adults. She taught me how to care deeply about those who are less able to care for themselves. Dad taught me customer service. And Granda taught me everything there was to know about merchandising and appealing to the eye. I'm a product of the environment I grew up in, and the one I shaped around me as I grew. I learned that language of teaching. That language changes depending on who and what you teach. First, I taught speech and drama to children and teens. Then computers to adults at night. I was only 18 then. I had to imagine I was teaching my granddad. In Australia, I was a homeschool teacher to three children. In China, a university lecturer to young adults from all over China. And in Ireland, I had learners from every corner of the world. Curiosity is key when we teach. Whether we coach, teach, or train. The more curious we get about how things are structured and said in other languages, the easier it becomes to infer if there's a linguistic slip. Thus, no breakdown occurs. Like you said, the brain is primed. We're primed to hear what's coming next before it's been spoken. So when someone doesn't speak in the same rhythm of the language, when their mouth isn't shaped around the sounds, there will often be slips in pronunciation. This doesn't make them mistakes, and that's what people look out for. But it does mean that the brain slips when it's hearing. It doesn't hear what it's predicting to hear, and so it has to work harder to try to understand the meaning. I have clients who come back to me after session 4 or 5 with a look of surprise on their faces, after we've done some work on reshaping their pronunciation, finding the rhythm, working a bit on stress or particular sounds. People are asking me more questions. We spoke for longer. Nobody seemed confused. I'm not as afraid to speak anymore. Christine, I didn't realize so much was being missed. Awareness is key. We don't know what we don't know until we become aware that something's happening differently. Cultural awareness is the same, the fourth aspect of the model. "Does anyone have any questions?" the presenter said. "No? Great. That means everybody understands," they're thinking. "Not necessarily." "Excuse me, can I stop you for a moment there?" "Oh my goodness. Did she just interrupt the vice president in the middle of their presentation?" "Sure. What's up?" "I didn't fully understand what you said that in that last part. How much was the deficit?"
$36 million.
"Okay, thank you for clarifying." "No problem. Now, what do we do about it?" The English-speaking, often American, but not always, industrialized world has a tendency to tell everyone else how to communicate better. Interrupt. Ask questions. Look them square in the eye and nod your head while they're speaking. Make sure you shake hands firmly. While this is true in many cultures, it's not true in them all. Listening across cultures is different. Last year, I was very glad of my Culture Active certification when, having multiple phone calls with the South African Afrikaans English speakers, on my first call, I couldn't get a word in edgeways. Irish people tend to be bursting with ideas and want to interrupt, but we don't. We listen courteously, presuming, as this is how conversation works in Ireland, that the speaker will pause and give you a chance to respond. But that's not culturally typical amongst South Africans, Afrikaans speakers. You have to interrupt if you want to speak. I felt sick the first few times I did it. My brain was in a tizzy. It's a strong interrupt you need to give. But that's how I needed to adapt my awareness and my mannerisms to converse with them effectively. I got used to it after a while. We got on great. It didn't cut the conversation at all. That's the mannerism of conversation with a South African. Not all South Africans, like you say. Cultural intelligence is as deep a mystery as consciousness. If you've not had a lot of experience, hiring a trainer is duly advised. I work with some of the best trainers and consultants in the world, so we'll always be able to find you an expert for your market need. To hear is not to listen. But to listen, we must first hear. Making the decision to listen differently can be difficult. Grainne Whale was difficult. So difficult, in fact, that Irish historians wrote her out of our history. She didn't conform to the pretty picture they wished to paint of a good, charitable, God-fearing Irish gusha, or Irish girl, or woman. You can taint the women and leave them off the pages, lads. But you can't take the blood out of the women. It seems we have something to be very thankful to the English for. Listing and mapping the true story of one of the most powerful women and chieftains ever to maintain the land and seas of Ireland, the difficult Grainne Whale. This International Women's Day, dare to be difficult. Have an opinion and share it. Do so in a way without reshaping yourself, that will allow it to be heard. Understand that everyone has a type, and you're not always going to be it. I'm not a fan of baldness, whether my name is Whale or not. I have a type, a preference for a particular face, a particular type of voice, particular interests, even a particular diet. Does that mean I can't listen to a person who doesn't match those preferences? Of course not. It just means I don't want to get into bed with them. Sorry, you can't unhear that either. Dare to be difficult. But change the connotation of the word. When something is difficult, it requires effort or skill to accomplish. It's challenging. But at the end of achieving a challenge, there is a reward. Men are more typically permitted to challenge things than women. Women who disagree with the norm, who challenge ingrained thinking, are seen as difficult. Even the Google definition of the character adjective, difficult, troublesome, tiresome, demanding, taken from the Oxford Language Dictionaries, uses a female name in the example of being difficult. Lily, it says, could be difficult. Well, guess what, Oxford? Lilian, the French male form of the name, can be difficult too. We need to start challenging connotation. If Grainne hadn't dared to be difficult, if the countless women throughout history who fought for the vote, for positions on boards, in organisational operations, in politics, science and aeronautics hadn't dared to be difficult, women would still be getting sectioned and housed in asylums because they didn't conform to the opinions and demands of their husbands. Most of my life I conformed because I didn't agree with general opinion. I keep myself to myself a lot of the time too, because it's too hard for me to sit in groups of people and share my real opinion. I'm told, even by my friends, to stop overanalyzing, overthinking, judging. The thing is that the responses I get are the results of others' discomfort and indifference. Most people don't want to see through themselves. The brain in general doesn't like to work hard. It likes things to be easy and comfortable. I don't really understand the meaning of comfortable. And I'm quite comfortable with that. Every moment of discomfort precedes an instance of discovery. That's the zone I want to be in. What I call the zone of discomfortable discovery. That place in a gravitational wave that contracts just before a massive expansion. The sick feeling before we do something scary that anticipates the thrill of success. The keenness before a first kiss, followed by the rewarding feeling of not having slobbered all over the person. Sorry, you can't unhear that either. This International Women's Day, ladies and How did you finish my sentence? Ladies, gender neutral, and gentlemen, dare to dive into the zone of discomfortable discovery. Dare, if you will, to be difficult. And I'll leave you with an exercise to try with your teams. I'd recommend booking me to facilitate it, or somebody else if you like, but preferably me. The reason being that facilitating conversations like this, safely, across communicators and cultures takes experience. I've had mixed groups of 10 or more different nationalities at a time. I've had students jump up in the middle of a class on the topic of crime and run out of the room because 10 days before they'd arrived in the country, they had been held at gunpoint. It's a delicate dance knowing what to ask, how to ask it, when to push and when to pull, how to adapt in a moment if you know you've said the wrong thing. You can damage a person or a group if it's not done right. Here's what you do. As a leader, first, check individually with people and how they would feel exploring these ideas. Give them time to think about it and ask what will happen first. It's really important to do this I was reading an article there yesterday that talked about the Gallup Leadership Survey. And what it's found is that people are feeling increasingly disconnected from their organizations. By speaking to people individually and giving them time to think about things, you not only increase their feeling of choice, which from a neuroscience perspective is essential, people need to feel like they have a choice, but you also help them feel connected. And again, tackling the issues of trust in the Gallup survey, you help connect and build more trust. So give them time to think about what you'll ask and what will happen first, and let them say no if they want to say no. It doesn't mean a no forever. Or it might mean a no, not like that, but can we do it like this? Then as a team, explore what listening and hearing means in your languages and cultures. What are the listening mannerisms in meetings? What do you notice about how others listen? Behaviors. Do they look up and away? Do they look down? Do they need to take notes? Do they have a pen turning in their hand all the time? Acknowledge how each other listens. I had a student once who always had a pen in his hand, and he'd do this little a semi-second tap. And I started to notice that he'd do the semi-second tap. So I went and asked him about it one day, and he said, yeah, it just helps me remember and keep focused when you're speaking. That was how he listened. What are the similarities and differences between the listening cultures in your organization? Write out some words, write out some mannerisms. Look at each other's language structures. Notice the differences in the patterns between how particular phrases are used to identify that you're listening, to inquire, to ask questions. What's the difference in the structures? Which are more or less direct than others? Then find a common language. What works for everybody on the team? Help people understand why being too direct might not work, or vice versa, when it's important to be direct, for efficiency, for example. Share some stories, like mine, about your experiences of being listened to and heard. Be gentle here. Psychological safety doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. Not everybody will want to share, and that's okay. Every week or bi-weekly, or depending on how often you choose to do this, as a leader, you can ask your people what could have been done differently or what they'd like to have happened. When I was a sales manager, I had a team of mixed nationalities and mixed levels of experience. Spain, Brazil, Mexico, Ireland, fresh out of college, 5 or 6 years experience, a little bit more experience, a very broad mix, and a bit of neurodivergence as well. And I used to leave notes. Outlook has this wonderful thing in emails that you can stick a little note as a comment in. So we were dealing with about 54 different active agents at a time, and I was the sales manager for all of them, but the team then took individual parts of the markets. But I knew the agents. I knew them intimately. I talked to them on the phone. I met them at events. So I knew their little idiosyncrasies. And when I'd see their emails come in, I can tell, this is how they're feeling. This is what will work. This is what won't work. This will make it faster or more efficient to answer them. So I'd leave in a couple of little notes for my team before I'd categorize the emails to them for action. And one day I did this feedback in a meeting, asking what people would like to be done differently, or what they would like to have happen. So one of the team separately brought me aside and said, look, I've been working here for years. I know I'm new to the team, and maybe this is something that you do with everybody. But when you put the comments into the emails, I feel like you're micromanaging me. The word micromanagement wasn't used, but that's what it was, what the reality of the feeling for her. I feel like you think I can't do the job, like you don't trust me. Oh my goodness, that's not at all what it was. I thought I was helping you. No problem. Thank you for the feedback. I won't do it anymore. So I stopped. And then I checked with everybody else how they felt about it. Would they like me to stop? Do they want me to continue? The rest of the team were less experienced. They said they wanted me to continue. So it shows you what we're doing. If it doesn't work for one, it doesn't mean it won't work for the rest. Asking what people want. Help us to come up with shared definitions, shared language and shared understanding. So that's the next step. Come up with a shared definition of listening and hearing in your team. Write it up. Draw it up. Represent it in whatever way will work for your people. And then role play some examples of it working and not working. Talk about reasons why people might forget, because it takes time to embed new habits, especially if you're from a different culture that does things completely differently. If your energy's low, if you're tired, if you're stressed, they're all going to affect being able to enact a new language or a new behavior. Decide how to address those challenges. When do you just leave it go? When do you step in and say, are you okay? Do you need a bit of help? Explore how people feel. Celebrate successes. Focus forwards after challenges. Don't be looking for the problems. And follow up every few weeks. In the concept of Ubuntu, they say, I am because we are. In the Zulu culture, it's customary and tradition to listen and wait for your turn to speak. When they say hello, they say, Sawubona, I see you. If you can take anything into your mind after this episode, it's to think of that word when you see people. Sawubona, I see you. I see you, and I'm going to listen, to hear. As always, thank you for listening. If you've been affected by anything that I've said in the episode, if you've got feedback, if you've got thoughts, if you'd like to tie me up and make me walk the plank because you completely disagree with me, please find me, send me a message and have a conversation with me. I love hearing from you. The more I hear from you, if you're a listener, the more questions you ask, the more I can answer the questions. The more comments you make, the more I can refer to your comments, and the more I can make content that matters to you. Please share this with a woman you know or a man you know who could benefit from hearing it. Like the podcast, star the podcast, download it. And until next week, could you uncaid the Rella or could you uncaid Shachtanella? I think I can say. Bonatí, agus buíochas.